Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
This is Dmitry Samarov from Chicago, Illinois, and I love listening to Vish Khanna's Creative Control because whether he's talking to a favorite musician or actor of mine or someone I've never heard of, it's as if he's introducing me to a new friend. And the way things are going, couldn't you use a new friend? Listen now.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Alyssa Cole is an award-winning and prolific American author who has received raves from the likes of the New York Times, Vulture, Library Journal, and Entertainment Weekly, and she currently calls the Caribbean island of Martinique home. Originally from Jersey City and a one-time Brooklyn resident, Cole writes historical, contemporary, sci-fi, and romantic novels, often rooted in the experiences of Black life and Black characters, which don't historically feature so prominently in such genre fiction. In the fall of 2020, Cole's psychological thriller, When No One Is Watching, was published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins. The book explores the insidious aspects of gentrification and how classism and racism inform the displacement of longtime residents and erase community histories and community spirit. Alyssa and I recently connected for a conversation about her life in Martinique and her perception of America from afar. The story of When No One Is Watching, and at least one other book she published around the same time that I neglected to read, sorry. The growing interest in black stories in mainstream pop culture, but also the increased prominence of white supremacy, affordable housing and the evils of real estate, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Zaki Ibrahim, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 597th episode of Creative Control, featuring the brilliant novelist Alyssa Cole, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Alyssa, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm well. First of all, where in the world are you?
I am in Martinique, which is in the French Caribbean.
Now, that sounds amazing. For those of us enduring the winter, I'm here in Canada, so that sounds good. How is that in reality? Is it as good as it sounds?
There are some really great parts and also some parts that, you know, I moved here from New York. So some things like missing pizza and bagels and winter. Sometimes me and my husband put on like these YouTube videos that are just like Nordic scenescapes with snow and ice. And it's like, oh, remember that?
I like, don't you find like living, I guess, like I grew up in Ontario and now I live in Alberta, Canada, very dynamic in terms of the seasons. You know, you get seasons, but then you live on a tropical island, it feels like there's not seasons, right? There's less change. Is that fair?
Yeah, like it does get cooler. Like right now it's cooler than it is in the summer, obviously. But it is weird. Like the first Christmases here, and even now it's a bit strange. Like it's festive, but it's not the same. Like I tried getting a real Christmas tree.
Right.
We tried it a couple of years, but like they basically get shipped over here, like on cargo ships with everything else. And then like sometimes it's just like already dried out. The needles are falling off. Now we just have a fake Christmas tree, which is fine. But, you know, things like that, like Christmas lights with the palm trees seem so strange to me still.
Well, you know, that's a cultural thing a little bit, I would say, because I remember my parents are from India and they moved here. I was born in Canada, but they the first few times, my earliest Christmas memories are of them like being told that they had to have a Christmas tree by somebody. And what they did, because they didn't know what that meant, they took like a house plant and stuck like the shaft of a hockey stick in it. And then tied lights around the hockey stick. Like, that's my first Christmas tree. Yeah. So they're trying to assimilate, but they didn't really, like, when you try to explain to someone, so wait a minute, once a year, you chop down a tree and then you put it in your house where it will die. Like, I mean, you've killed a tree and then you put you put a bunch of stuff on it, and that's, what does that signify? Like, it's very
confusing. Just look at it. All of that work for nothing. There are some cool Christmas cultural things here. Like, there's something called Chante Noël, which is kind of like Christmas caroling. You either go to, sometimes they have it at a community hall, and also people have it at their homes. And sometimes there's a band or a live band, or sometimes you just play a recording. And it's basically like singing. There's a book with all of the island Christmas carols, which are in French and in Creole. And you just all sing together. And it's like, I mean, obviously Christmas caroling is a thing in the North America, but it's not quite as popular where I'm from.
Right.
And you don't really gather like that to sing. So it's like something that's a strong part of the culture here and was weird to me, but is also like really cool and something that now we incorporate into our Christmas celebrations.
So often when other cultures, adapt, Western type Christmas songs, they take the melody, maybe they add different words, there's different meanings mm-hmm. here and there. Are there, fully original Caribbean Christmas songs that you've encountered? Like they're just like about Caribbean life, or are you singing, how do you sing Jingle Bells? About, dashing through the snow. Yeah, there's no Jingle Bells, right?
There's no Jingle Bells. Most of them are taken from, so everyone here speaks French or French Creole.
Right.
And so some of them are taken from, French Christmas carols, and some seem to be fully Creole Christmas carols.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. They might have some origin in French songs that I don't know.
I see. Okay.
But there's no Jingle Bells. There is Silent Night and Oh Holy Night and, the classics like that.
Right. The religious stuff is pretty much left
yeah.
intact. Right.
Yeah.
So, but are there then, by the same token, are there original songs that you've encountered? You're like, wow, that is a different twist on the Christmas song that I did not expect.
There are songs that seem original to me because they're like about island stuff. but talking to your neighbor or calling to your neighbor. And a lot of it is call and response and drums. And like, if you don't have a live band and you're listening to the recording, someone will pull out a drum or, bang on a bottle with a spoon. So like that kind of twist is the fun part. It's like very, like you're often dancing and it's not just like standing there and singing. Like usually it's like very like a dance party plus Christmas carols.
Yeah. Well, it sounds magical on the one hand. And I'm sorry you're missing the ice and snow. I've never said that before. No one's ever missed the ice and snow, but I appreciate it. I think that's something we've all been enduring during the pandemic. You don't know what you've got till it's gone. You don't know what you're mm-hmm. missing. You kind of take it for granted. So yeah, I mean, it's true. Here in America and Canada, the words Green Christmas are so upsetting to people. Like, there's no snow. It was a green Christmas. People get really upset. So you're just constantly in a green or sandy,
yes.
sandy Christmas zone. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. I never really asked you why you are there. Why did you leave New York for Martinique?
I actually got married and my husband is a teacher here and I was an editor. So it was easier for me to work remotely and to move here than for him to, the school systems are different and the visa process is different for moving to the U.S. than
right.
from moving to France. So in the end, it seemed like it would be easier for me to move here. And it was also like a fun, getting to live on an island. And like I vastly overestimated my level of French before I moved here.
Yes.
And I'm like, I've been here for 6 years and, I can speak okay. My tutor is very supportive of me. But there's also, there's French. And then because there's French and French Creole here, there's a different accent.
Yes. Yes.
So sometimes people don't understand me or sometimes I don't understand people. And also sometimes people, and I feel like this happens in a lot of places, like they hear my accent, even though I'm speaking French.
Yes.
And some people are like, oh, I don't speak English. And I'm like, I'm speaking to you in French. Right?
They hear the elocution and assume it's English.
Yeah.
That's famously in Quebec. If you have French, if you're not from Quebec and you have French, and you attempt to, say, order a meal. Remember restaurants? When you used to be able to go to a restaurant and you tried to order a meal in French, and they could detect that, you had come from away, so to speak, they would revert to English, which my wife went to school and did French immersion. So she was always, self-conscious about it, like trying to speak French and keep her chops up. But they would revert to English, and she felt highly insulted. Give me a break here. I'm doing my best. And like, I won the French award in grade 8 and grade 9, but it's gone. I miss my French. It's a big regret of mine. I need to fix it. I want to learn French again My kids are in French immersion, so and they make fun of me. They make fun. My daughter's six. She's like, Papa, what does this mean? What's this word mean? And I say, well, that means horse. She's like, oh, every time I get it right, she's upset. So anyway, I don't know if you've got that situation going on. Do you have children? Do you have children who are trying to learn French?
No, okay. I do have multiple bilingual pets,
pets
which
okay.
are not the same as children.
Very similar, very similar behaviorally in terms of upkeep. I'd say it's quite similar. Yeah. Okay, so they're learning French a little bit now because
they're French, and sometimes they speak when I speak to them in English. Sometimes they pay attention, and sometimes they just pretend they don't know what I'm saying.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, it is nice to get to speak to you, and the occasion is I just finished your novel, When No One Is Watching, which, as we're speaking, I believe is your latest work. Is that fair?
Actually, I had another book come out in December.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is a romance. It's called How to Catch a Queen, and it's the kickoff of a spinoff series called The Runaway Royals. And it's basically, it's a political romance about an arranged marriage in a modern set, in a modern day fictional African kingdom.
Oh.
That is basically dealing with a lot of the things places all over the world are dealing with, which is figuring out how to balance modernity with tradition, the needs of their people with tradition, and how to create a better, well, this is the fictional fantasy part, how to make a better world for their citizens in addition to moving forward with, you know, into modern times.
I see. Okay. Well, I've obviously, first of all, congratulations on that. I've yet to read that book. I just finished. Just so we're clear and I don't seem totally out to lunch, When No One Is Watching came out in what year then?
Oh, it came out in September of 2020, and the next book came out in December.
How can you do that? How are you? You've written a lot of books, right? Like I looked at when the book tells you you're reading a book and it says for further reading or read more from, and I was looking at it, I'm like, holy Lord, I can't, there's so many of these books. How many books have you written?
I actually don't know. In the teens, the high teens, I think.
And since when? When did you first publish your first book?
My first book was published in 2014.
So you're in the teens already. That's only 7 years. That's remarable. You're just on a prolific clip. I mean, how did you even get started doing this? Because that's a lot of people when I talk to, you know, when I speak with authors or when I speak to people about authors, the audacity. You know, the audacity of thinking I can write stories, I can write books, that baffles people. How do you even motivate yourself? Do you remember what was the spark for you to get writing?
Well, I've always written, like even when I was a kid. One of the things was that, you know, once I learned how to read, I just became a prolific reader and was reading everything in my parents' bookshelves and the school bookshelves. And a lot of the time it was really difficult to see, I mean, I loved books, but it was often difficult to find people who looked like me and my friends. And like I grew up in the Bronx and then Jersey City. And so I was surrounded by people from all over the world. And then I would read books and like everyone looked the same. Hmm. And so generally when I was writing stories, it was like, you know, people who look like me and my friends. And just getting tired of reading about the same kinds of characters. And then that kind of just carried over into my adult writing, I guess.
Right.
And I basically knew I wanted to be a writer. Well, when I was a kid, I wanted to be either a writer or a comic book artist or a paleontologist because I was a child of the 90s. I watched Jurassic Park. I had my little fossils from the Museum of Natural History. And I stopped, you know, really drawing. So maybe that will happen one day if I actually put some effort into it. But I always was writing short stories. And I was like, one day I'll write a book. One day I'll write a book. And, you know, like the running joke when someone wants to write a book. And my friends were like, oh, yeah, one day you'll write that. Or, yeah, that'll happen when you write your book. And then it was really around 2010 when I realized if I wanted to write a book, I had to write it. Like, it wouldn't just magically happen one day.
Right.
Like, I would have to put in the work of actually finishing the books that I was starting instead of just starting new books. And the first time I finished a book was actually for, I found out about National Novel Writing Month. Hmm. And, you know, it, which is, for anyone who doesn't know, it's in every November. And I think they also have Camp NaNoWriMo in April, which is you try to write a 50,000 word book in 30 days.
Oh, and
the,
wow.
The point, yeah. And the point of this is not always, you know, to have a publishable book, but to show yourself that you can do it, or to make a draft that you can then, you know, edit intensely or add to have a completed book.
Well, that's,
so I had a story that, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and there's a website, and they have like sprints, and, you know, in non-COVID times, they would have people meeting at coffee shops to write together. So it's like a really community-based effort that kind of helps you feel motivated to finish.
Yeah.
Well, and even if you don't finish, you have something more than what you started with.
So building motivations and also forming, I guess fostering that camaraderie among writers, because it's such a solitary pursuit. I've talked mm-hmm. to many writers who are lamenting the fact that they put out books this year and they can't get together for, you know, writers' festivals or other kinds of events.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating to them because you spend all this time on your own, more or less. I mean, it's fascinating to me that you mentioned that part of the activity is getting together to write together. I've not heard of that. I mean, most people tend to write with it. Well, I guess you work with editors and stuff. That's true. But I've never, you don't often think of, unless it's a collaborative work, you don't often think of a solitary writer collaborating with too many external people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's like, that's the fun part, because you can go, you can write, take a few minutes to talk to someone, or if someone gets stuck on something, they can say, oh man, I'm stuck on this idea. So it's like a really fun experience. And there are people who have participated for years and years and, like, you know, maybe not winning or succeeding every year, but getting work done on books and like working on set, moving toward the goal of finishing a
yeah,
book.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's fascinating. I want to home in on something you said earlier about how you were seeing when you observed writing, you noticed that most people looked the same. And they didn't look like you and your friends, or sound like you and your friends. Can you elaborate upon that? I feel like I know where you're coming from, but can you speak on that a little bit?
So basically, and you know, there have always been writers of color, but the availability of the books when I was younger just wasn't the same as it is now. And publishers also weren't putting out as many books as they are now, it seems. And so most of the books I was reading were books by white authors with white characters. Mm. And, you know, I love so many of those books, but at a certain point you start to wonder, like, okay, do kids like me get to have adventures? Do kids like me get to have like romance and go through portals and, you know, all of the other stuff that you're reading again and again in these other books and
yeah.
in these books. So I think part of it was just being like, well, this seems to be a problem. I love writing. Maybe I can write these stories for myself. And then eventually that led to, well, if I feel this way, maybe there are other people who want to read these things too, or who feel left out of this too.
Yeah. Seems to be a particular emphasis on this in the last decade. When I think of the when you think of like in pop culture, the work of Jordan Peele, of course, with the horror films he's made and the sci-fi elements of those. Lovecraft Country. Did you watch Lovecraft Country by chance?
I did. I didn't finish yet, but I did. And the beginning was the episodes I saw were just great.
Yeah.
And it kind of actually, what you said kind of is something that really resonates with me. And even if you watch Black Panther, when I was watching it and you see, like for me, when I was watching it, I loved the movie, but also I was like, I can see this very specific thing where there were elements of, you know, superhero movie, James Bond movie, sci-fi, and like all of these different elements put together. And it was like, I can see that. And I don't know if it was consciously done, but like, here are all of the things where we've never really gotten to see ourselves in a movie.
Yeah.
And it seemed like he was consciously trying to fit in what was possible in the movie to kind of explore all of these things that have typically not included Black people. I feel like a lot of creators have that feeling of like, okay, here are all of these different genres where we aren't represented. And if you have the opportunity, yeah. you're like, I'm going to try to get us into as many genres as we, well, that's part of, it's not, and it's not even like a manifesto or like a really conscious thing. For me, at least, it's like afterwards, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. Well, this is just something I like, and I want to see, you know, a variety of people in. So I'm going to write it.
Yeah, it's fascinating, though, because I appreciate what you're saying about notions of representation in this type of media. And you are also someone who, in this book that I just read, you know, science fiction has a role, so to speak, but it's intertwined. Or at least nefarious aspects of, yeah, no, I would say there's some dystopian, obviously some dystopian stuff going on in your book, Jordan Peele's work, Lovecraft Country. What I was going to say is I find it fascinating that beyond simply asserting, you know, representation of Black people in these genres that are, you know, infamously, or at least historically do not include them in a prominent role, often racism is intertwined within it. So these things go, they're not only exploring these sort of genre stories, they're incorporating lived experience, they're incorporating racism. So it becomes a sort of meta exercise. Like not only are we, you know, asserting ourselves into these genres where we've been excluded from, we're going to talk about a possible, one of the subplots or main plots is going to be the reasons why.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm sorry, I didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fascinating to me that racism plays a role in most of the stories we're seeing. Do you have any perspective on why that would be?
I think in a way it's a type of processing and a type of catharsis, and also a way of addressing it without having to like write a thesis. And like, this is nothing against thesis writers or academic writers, but for me often when, so I write romance, and within romance, I write sci-fi, historical, and contemporary, and now I write thrillers.
Yeah.
And when I'm thinking about these things, you know, often when it comes to genre literature or genre media, people kind of see it as unimportant. But in reality, so many more people are consuming genre media than they are reading history books, or like reading a nonfiction history book or watching like a documentary. So for me, when I'm writing these things, and again, I'm often just writing about things that I'm interested in, but I feel like it's in a way a safer space to explore tough topics like racism and misogyny and like, you know, white supremacy and government and things like that, because you are crafting this world and you can also choose how to address it and how it gets resolved.
Yeah.
And I think that for, you know, creators coming from groups that have been traditionally marginalized, being able to do what you love, create the art that you love, but also to address things that can be difficult to address, like in a straightforward conversation, or can be things that people would shy away from if it was in a straightforward format of like, here is a documentary about racism, as opposed to here is Get Out.
Yeah, I would think maybe an analogy that works is like writing a catchy protest song. Like you package the message in a way that is infectious and palatable, more palatable. So you're getting to the issues, but you're also like the expression would be, you're not only trying to provoke thought, but you're trying to move bodies. Like you're trying to get people to viscerally react to something on some level. So I can see where you're coming from there for sure. I do want to get into your book because, and again, I apologize for not keeping up with your prolific publishing schedule.
It's okay.
But this is what
this
was sent to me in the fall and I started reading it and then other things happened and then I started reading it again recently and I really, really loved it. And
thank you.
And I guess I may not be a genre reader on some level. Like this is a bit different than the fiction I usually read. But I was totally drawn in. It obviously has a cinematic kind of flavor. Like, I can picture it. Like, it's very vividly written, I will say. And I hope someone picks this up and turns it into something beyond this. Not that the book is fine. The book is enough. You've done a great job with this, but that's where my mind always goes, like, wow, I can. Sometimes, do you ever have that? You read a thing and you have images?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You want to see someone manifest it? Like the, yeah. Anyway, yeah. So just sort of to catch people up who haven't yet partaken of this book, can you summarize the plot and story, I suppose, of When No One Is Watching? Because I don't want to do it in an injustice, and I'd like to hear it from you. Do you mind doing that?
Oh, I don't mind. The book is basically, it's about a woman named Sydney Green who has moved away from, was born and raised in Brooklyn. She moved away for a few years and she comes back home expecting to kind of rebuild her life. She had a tough time. She comes back home expecting to rebuild her life, moves back into the building, the brownstone that her mom owns. And, you know, she's thinking things will go back to normal. But because of gentrification, everything is changing around her. And it's basically a gentrification psychological thriller. You know, the tagline is Rear Window meets Get Out. Yeah. And it's basically she decides to, you know, her mom is sick. She's like extremely stressed out and still dealing with the fallout of some mental health issues. And she decides to make a walking tour of her neighborhood that celebrates the history of the residents who live there and Black history of the neighborhood.
Right.
And she gets an unexpected research assistant in her new neighbor, Theo, who is a white man who has moved to the neighborhood with his girlfriend. And he is going through it, basically their book going through it in different ways.
Yeah.
They both have secrets and they kind of stumble upon what might be a conspiracy, a gentrification conspiracy, or might be Sydney spiraling into some kind of mental health issues.
Right.
And you have to read it to find out what's
up. Yes, we will be careful not to give too much away here, of course, so people are enticed to read it. Yeah, but this is fascinating. I think a lot of us have pondered gentrification from different angles, particularly nefarious ones. What was it about gentrification that sparked your interest in it and to take this particular tack with it? Because it's a fascinating idea. I left the book being like, I know that in like a few days I'm going to be like, maybe it's all true. Maybe that is what gentrification is. You know what I mean?
Honestly, one of the weirdest things is seeing things in the news. I mean, it's very much rooted in reality. At several, you know, some of it is not, I hope, but a lot of it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Like all of the history in the book. And part of it comes from, I've written several historical romance novels and novellas set in America in different time periods from 1776 to 1960. And, you know, I have a series set during the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, you know, as I've researched all of these periods over the years, you see the same kind of oppression and kind of just malevolence against like marginalized groups crop up over and over again.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a trained historian, but I imagine they feel the same way sometimes researching things and then looking at the news and seeing similar things happening again. And it just kind of feels like, is anyone noticing that this stuff wow. just keeps happening?
That's a very fascinating, it's a fascinating perspective given what what America is going through.
Yeah. Yeah.
In particular, like just seemingly just weirdly ahistorical, even when people point out, like, wait a minute, we've already gone through this. Like,
yeah,
why
yeah.
are we doing this again? I mean, I don't mean to get too political, but even voting for Republicans, it seems like someone pointed this out on Twitter the other day. Like, every time there's a Republican administration,
yeah.
the economy is left in shambles. Democrats are left to clean it up, but then they're voted out again. Like, why? It's like people have both long-term and short-term memory issues when it comes to obviously, the rise of white rise. It's not even a rise. The I guess renewed interest in white supremacy. I will say, like from mainstream media, like, oh yeah, we should probably pay attention to this thing where, you know, people of color are like, yeah, this has always been there, you know, like,
yeah.
So anyway, yeah, it is. That's an interesting point, too, that people don't pay attention or pay attention to case studies where other cities have endured gentrification, which seems on its surface to be a clean, nice, shiny, happy, clean thing. But that no one talks about the displacement of marginalized people and where do these people go when they're moved out of places. Yeah. So,
and one of the things that, you know, I lived in Brooklyn for many years. And like I said, I grew up in Jersey City, which if you're unfamiliar, it's basically right across the Hudson River from New York City and has now become, you know, before, you know, used to be the place no one wanted to move to, much like Brooklyn. And now it's also become gentrified. So, you know, going home to visit my family and seeing these like huge new buildings and all of the different, you know, bars and luxury things. So going back home to Jersey City and seeing all of these, you know, basically markers of gentrification, which in some ways are good, you know, it's not like it's all bad. But then also one of the things that really sparked this for me was that my parents bought this house 20 years ago at this point, the house that they live in. Yeah. But then the neighborhood became desirable. And it was like, you know, the local government saying, oh, yeah, we're just going to make all these changes and everything will be great. And then a couple of years ago, they just really jacked up the property taxes and basically made them so high that no one will be able to live there unless they are making a certain amount of money per year, basically, if they're already rich. Yeah. And the people who live there already, like, you know, many of whom have lived there most of their lives, if not all of their lives, will have to move because trying to pay the property tax for 1 year would like cut into a huge portion of their income. So it's like the things like that that are not necessarily like physically strong arming people out of their homes, but just finding all of these ways that are legal to, or bending the rules of legality even sometimes. And then, like, you know, the people, realtors showing up to try and get you to sell your house and, and, you know, can be good for some people if they are looking to move and they can make a nice profit from the, you know, the difference between what they paid for the house and what it costs now. But then there are also people who, you know, if they move, where are they going to go? Because their whole community that they've had for their entire life has been in this neighborhood.
Well, I'm not complaining here because my wife and I are both working and we feel fortunate in this era to be working our jobs, but we literally moved from Guelph, Ontario, where I lived and where we met. I lived there for 23 years and we would bid on houses. We have two children and we had a two-bedroom house and in downtown of that small little city, university town, college town. And we moved all the way to Edmonton, Alberta, where her parents are from. To be ostensibly to be closer to them, but we also got new jobs and all that stuff. But we moved ostensibly because we could not move within the city. We bid on like 12 houses and we could not get, like, we'd be outbid by tens of thousands of dollars on these fixer uppers from people from Toronto who sold their, you know, $1 million shitholes. And like they just were able to do it. And then they could outbid anyone in Guelph. So we were, I feel like, when people say, well, wow, you moved all the way across the country. And when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, we were vaguely displaced. Like, again, not complaining. We're doing better than a lot of people probably are, I would say, and feel comfortable in that and, you know, not feeling economic stress. But still, it was a big move.
And it's, Yeah, and it's like not entirely your choice to do it. And then you think of, and like one of the things, I mean, this is an idea that has been in my head. Basically, like the first week I moved to Brooklyn, which was, 2005, I guess. I very vividly remember that there was a man standing on his stoop, arguing, holding his child, and he was arguing with the landlord. And he said, "Where am I supposed to go?"
Yeah,
like he was yelling at the landlord about raising the rent. And it's like one of those things that was so many years ago, but always stuck in my head. And every time I would see new changes to the neighborhood, I would think of like, "Where did this guy go?" Because I was working, I mean, I was an editor. I wasn't making very much money at all.
Yeah.
But like, even I moved so many times when I lived in Brooklyn, and each time, you know, and like the longest place, the place I lived for the longest was like definitely an illegal apartment. That was one apartment cut into two. And then like when I moved in, I realized there wasn't a kitchen sink. And, but like, it was because that was what I could afford. I made them put in a kitchen sink. So I eventually had one. They initially told me I could wash my dishes in the bathtub. And I was like, hey, okay. But like, you know, it's that kind of thing. And then like each time I could, even like, when I eventually was making a bit more money, I still had to keep moving out further and further because the rent prices were like going sky high at this point.
Yeah.
And I always, I would be looking at places in like Coney Island, which is like literally, you know, at the ocean. And I would be like, I can't, even these places in Coney Island are getting super expensive. And like, where are people who are working minimum wage jobs or less than minimum wage jobs, where are they going to be able to afford to live?
We have so many, many sort of, I don't know, parallel crises going on. But I do think that affordable housing, rent control, real estate, market manipulation kind of stuff, like that should really be front of mind because I've worked with younger people than I, you know, in their 20s and their 30s. And they just full on say, no, I'll never own a home. Like they've already resigned themselves. I'll never own a car even maybe, you know, this is just the way it's going to be. I'll live where I can and I'll rent where I can. But I'm like, what the hell? Like what kind of, that's the opposite of the promise that I felt growing up. Like I take these things for granted. I assumed, maybe I didn't think about it too much, but I remember when I suggested my wife and I look at the first house, the house we ended up buying. But I didn't really think we could buy a house. Like, it just, you know, when you're younger, you're like, can we buy a house? How do you buy a house? I don't know how to do that. And then you do it, and then you assume everyone, you realize everyone sort of does it. But now I'm starting to realize that not everyone can do it. And I mean, some of that comes through in this book, in your novel. And it's a real problem that we kind of skirt around. Again, the pandemic has sort of taken over all the mental energy we have, you know, about and also the loss of jobs. But that's all tied into it. That's all tied into where am I supposed to go? Where are we supposed to live without money? And when you keep raising property taxes, as you say, it's really... So on that level, I think your book is very timely and very relevant. Does it feel particularly relevant for pandemic times, do you think? Or is it separate? It feels a bit separate.
It feels a bit separate. It felt... really, like, you know, after the past summer in the U.S. and the book was coming out in September, it felt really uncomfortably relevant. And, you know, there were a lot of parallels to things going on. And one of the most disturbing ones was after the murder of Breonna Taylor, when police officers mistakenly executed a no-knock warrant in the middle of the night in her house. And then later it came to light that part of the reason for that was because there was a push, a gentrification push, to clear the neighborhood, which was a historically Black neighborhood. So they were trying to execute warrants on people to basically get them out of the apartments they were in if they were going to be in jail. So it's like one of those things, like, where obviously I knew about these things, I was researching all of these things, but then like, it's like reality can sometimes be so much worse than what you were even creating in fiction.
That is a weird aspect of science fiction that I don't think people talk about enough, is that there's a prescience to science fiction writing. I'm not saying this book, would you agree this book has elements of science fiction, obviously, towards the end maybe, or?
I think it does. Does a bit. Yeah.
It does seem to me that there's prescience in science fiction writing. I can't tell if it's like some sort of self-fulfilling prophecy thing happening where enough people read a thing and then it comes true. But like, I feel like in your book, like you say, like weirdly it had this eerie prescience when we lost Breonna Taylor, when the police murdered her, and when you read more into it, this was a push towards gentrification. That's all in your book. People vanishing, disappearing, you know, out of thin air, like people just minding their business and being removed or disappeared. I mean, that's very frightening. And so you kind of conjured this, and now but you conjured it based on some sense that maybe it could be true, I guess. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of a lot of the things in the book are inspired by things I read and, you know, have experienced and are just historically true in the United States. And just like, you know, one of the things too is kind of, and I don't read reviews, but sometimes when people tag me in reviews, like, I don't know.
It's kind of the worst. Kind of the worst, isn't it?
On Instagram, it's like a beautiful picture of the book. And I'm like, oh, someone tagged me. And then it's like, this book was totally unbelievable. And I'm like, why did you tag me?
Yeah, people want you to know that they didn't like your stuff. Like, that is a weird part of the culture.
Yeah. So I definitely, like, I don't go through reading reviews looking for things to get upset about. Sure. But sometimes when I was seeing people saying that, literally as there were these, like, you know, huge marches and peaceful protesters getting attacked by police officers.
Yeah.
I was like, what world are you living in where this was completely unbelievable to you? I mean, you don't have to like the book, you don't have to like the writing, but that the idea of it was unbelievable when you could literally turn on the TV and see some of the things that happened in the book happening in real life, unfortunately, was like, it was like, okay, well, this is why these things happen, because they can literally be happening right in front of people's faces, and they'll be like, oh no, well, that's not, you know, they're like, something drives them to pretend it's not really happening, or there must be some other explanation.
We have a real reckoning with reality that we have to deal with across the board. And, you know, as we're speaking, the conspiracy theories have never felt more intense and given more airspace, given more breathing room. And so when you realize what people are willing to believe.
Yeah. And this is the thing. Yeah. Like this is the thing to me, because, like, you know, you're going to believe in, like, lizard people and, like, satanic whatever,
cults.
You know, satanic cults and all of that other stuff. But things that are, like, literally historically, you can look it up in a book, you can look it up in FBI files, there's historical record, and people will be like, well, no, I don't think it's true, or I don't think it's that bad. And it's like, for me, the thing is, like, obviously I can go very deep into conspiracy, but conspiracy rooted in reality, because some of the things that have happened in reality are much weirder than any, like, real life conspiracy theory. Like, you think about, like, the FBI calling Martin Luther King and, like, trying to get him to commit suicide, and, like, all of the, like, random, and, like, part of it too, and which is kind of an undercurrent to what I was feeling when writing the book, is like, there's all of this energy put toward, you know, racism and negativity and oppression. And all of that energy is like, it's so useless. Yeah. It can be used for something so much better than these, like, really bizarre things that people do just in the name of, like, white supremacy. Yeah. I don't know. It's like, when I think about it, it's just really frustrating above anything else, because I'm like, there's really no logical reason. There are reasons. But when you think of it, it's like, you're wasting all this energy. Like, go take a nap. I don't know. It's just like, we could be so much more advanced as a people if, like, the massive amount of energy that is currently put into oppression was just directed elsewhere.
Yeah, I would agree. And I will say, like, based on our, you know, the reading we've just sort of performed of your book, unfortunately there are some conspiracies that are rooted in truth. And so it sort of gives credence to all conspiracy theories when one is proven to be correct. So that's an issue that we're dealing with as well, right? Like, you can't. Anyway,
one thing that was interesting was, like, you know, I did a couple of book clubs, and I won't talk about the scenes because it would spoil it for anyone who didn't read.
Yeah.
But people were like, "Oh, that was definitely based on this, right?" Like, and they talked about a specific event, historical event that happened, and I was like, "No." That was the part that I thought I made up completely. And unfortunately, even the things that I thought I made up completely had happened.
Yeah.
And it was, like, unfortunately. on a lesser, not a lesser degree, in a different way, but basically the same thing. And again, this goes back to the thing of people saying that certain things were totally unbelievable. And then finding out that even the things that I was like, okay, if they want to talk about this one specific thing, then I guess I don't think it's unbelievable, but it is the thing that I made up. And then people being like, oh no, actually that really happened. Here's the link to the story like that happened like, you know, 20 years ago in this place. And I was like, oh, okay. So really again, there's nothing unbelievable.
There's so there's prescience. We talked earlier about people not, you know, repeating the past in an erroneous way, but we also repeat the past, or the past and history can sometimes seep into us subconsciously. So you may have come upon that and thought you'd conjured this fantastical thing only to be told, you know, that actually happened. So maybe you read it at some point, or maybe your intuition was that probably could have happened. And, you know, I think that's
generally, and like, I actually get that a lot with my various books.
Yeah.
One of my friends calls me a witch, but which is why I have started to try to write some like explicitly, like, because like one of my series is like that I'm working on now is a dystopian, and I'm like, okay, I really have to make sure, be careful about what I'm writing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
you might have power you don't even realize.
But I think part of it is kind of just like absorbing, you know, reading and absorbing. And even if I didn't read the specific thing, like you said, reading enough to be able to imagine the possibility of a particular thing having happened.
Yeah.
Because I know other things have happened, and that would be like a possible step in a bad direction, in a worse direction.
Yeah. You know, we began this conversation talking about how you're on this Caribbean island in Martinique. And I guess I wonder now that we're, you know, we've talked about what we've talked about, are you kind of happy as an American to not be in America, given all that's going on? Like, I know we talked about how you miss snow and ice. So that's impossible. But politically, socially, like, is it interesting even to observe what's going on from afar?
It's really weird. Like, on the one hand, it feels bad because, you know, my family and most of my friends are all in the U.S. So it's kind of like watching this, you know, boulder rolling down the mountain from far away and being like, hey, get out of the way of that boulder. But, you know, they can't really do anything. But at the same time, and I've talked to someone about this before, I've said that I don't know if I could have written this book if I was in the U.S. Because moving here, and like here, it's not some perfect paradise. I mean, you know, it's very beautiful, but all countries have their issues.
Well, I mean, you're talking about gentrification. You're in a tourist trap there, right?
Yeah. And it's not quite as touristy as other islands, but there is, you know, that aspect, and, you know, it's come into play with COVID and having tourists come.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. But, you know, one of the things that I really realized when I moved here, because the island is majority Black, mm-hmm. is that there is a different, I didn't realize how stressed out I was being in the U.S., even though I lived in New York. But it was things like, you know, when I go into a store, am I going to be followed around the store?
Yeah.
If a police officer stops me to talk to me, what's going to happen? Like, you know, things like that. Whereas here, like, there are just like all of the like countless microaggressions or not even microaggressions, just like logistics that are running in the back of your head at all times for what you will do if you encounter a certain situation that I don't have to think about here.
Mm-hmm.
And like people have problems with the police here and stuff like that. You know, that's a separate thing, but it's, I don't know. It kind of, I was like, there was this whole level of anxiety that I didn't realize I was carrying with me until I got someplace and was there for a period of time and realized, oh, if I walk into a store here, I'm not scared to like reach in my bag and answer my phone if my phone starts ringing or things like that. And that's also kind of a bit what went into Sydney's in the book, her kind of anxiety and fatigue and mental health issues, is that there is this kind of weight that you know, Black Americans and people from other marginalized groups who, in one way or another, have a target on them, carry with them at all times. This idea of, like, at any moment, something could happen and I wouldn't be able to do anything about it.
Yeah, the psychological toll of racism is, I think, maybe only finally being addressed more regularly. It's just sort of been just a part of our society, but I think actually getting into how it impacts people, how they function, how what they're thinking when they leave their homes every day is finally starting to be recognized a bit more. And with Sydney, you've certainly created a character who's bearing the trauma of that, among other things. So anyway, it's a beautifully written book, and it's a really, I will say it's an entertaining book, if I may. Like, it's a compelling book. It's very heavy, but I hope people recognize that it's very entertaining.
Yeah, I really tried to, I didn't want it to be like trauma porn.
Yeah,
like,
no, exactly.
It was very important to me. Like, I wanted to really balance having these really heavy issues, but I also wanted people to laugh. I wanted there to be a bit of romance and like suspense, because I feel like, and this is something I always, if I'm writing about a topic like that, I feel like you really have to give the reader breathing room. Like, yeah. You can't just have like this relentless, like, even if in reality stuff like this can be relentless, like, there has to be some breathing room. And also, like, in reality, even when things are really terrible, there are still times when you laugh or when you like are thinking about other stuff. So I tried to really balance and make it entertaining, as well as, you know, discussing these tough issues, but I also wanted to like enjoy themselves while reading it.
Yeah, it's provocative and humorous, and like I said, I use the term entertaining as a catch-all for whatever that means. It'll make you upset, it'll make you laugh. It's a thriller. It's a true thriller, if I might say. I want to ask you what's next. You alluded to a couple of things you were working on, but what is in your immediate future? What are you trying to get done? What will we hear from you or see from you, I guess, next?
I have some things I'm working on that I can't talk about yet. But the
this is a standard refrain from all of the writers I have on the show, because I'm totally understandable. But you alluded to some of them, so I ask.
The next book that is coming out is called How to Find a Princess. So How to Catch a Queen came out in December, and that was the first book in the series, and it's set in this kind of, it's like, in a way, it's like a Bluebeard retelling, a 1001 Nights retelling, but romance, like, no one is getting killed. Like, spoiler, no one is dying in the book, but kind of based on that. And the next book is a queer Anastasia retelling of a sort.
Yeah,
it's a modern day story with a woman who has really strong reasoning for not wanting anything to do with royalty, and then a really annoying chaos Muppet investigator shows up on her doorstep telling her that she is most likely the long lost heir to the throne of a small island kingdom and trying to convince her to go with her. And then they, you know, they have an adventure getting to the island.
Okay, so these things, that sounds fascinating. These things are in progress now, or do they have release dates?
How to Find a Princess will be out on May 25th, I believe.
Okay.
And How to Catch a Queen is already out.
So All right, that's right. That's the book I missed, is that right? The one I've been beating myself up over this whole time? Feeling badly? No, I'll obtain a copy of that too. I want to read that. That sounds very, very interesting. If you want people to kind of keep tabs on you and not, but also not tag you in questionable reviews of your work, where would you like to send them? I believe you have a website, right? AlyssaCole.com.
Yep, AlyssaCole.com. And also you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at AlyssaColeLit, L-I-T. And on Twitter, I'm usually talking about book stuff. On Instagram, you can see pictures of my pets and my chickens.
Oh, chickens. That sounds fun. Yeah. A lot of upkeep with the chickens, right? You got to keep Chickens might, they were probably like, the chickens were like, what the hell? We were in Brooklyn. Now we're in on this Caribbean island. This is great. Now there's French all the time. What the hell is going on?
These chickens actually, like, they were here when we moved into our house. They were just like, the first batch of chickens were, they were just kind of wandering around in the garden. And then we started feeding them. And then they were like, well, we are your chickens now. And that is how we came to be chicken owners. And then we also just have like a lot of roosters because, you know, then they had babies.
Right.
Babies turned to roosters. I'm honestly surprised they haven't been crowing like on multiple podcasts. You can just hear the dogs are acting up now.
I can hear them. Yeah,
it's the roosters. It's usually the roosters.
That's fascinating. I've never heard of fowl inclusions. You, normally it's like we want the washer, we want the dryer. No one's like, and you get, we want the chickens. We want the roosters and the chickens. That's good. That's a good deal you struck, I would say. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, the new or the latest, no, it's not even. I'll start this again. One of Alyssa's latest books is called When No One Is Watching. We've been discussing it. It's out on William Morrow, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. And Alyssa, this was a real pleasure. Thank you for the time. And I wish you the best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you so much. It was great speaking with you.
Very special thanks again to Alyssa Cole for appearing on this, the 597th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode, you've heard about it and you're looking for it, and you can't find it for some reason, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook, you can follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, or follow me directly on Twitter and Instagram at Vish Khanna. Please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content that I put there on the Patreon there. Old audio interviews, sometimes video stuff if I can find it. I haven't really, as I'm speaking to you, I haven't put a lot of video stuff up. I haven't put any video stuff up there in the exclusives, but I'm going to. I'm sure I have stuff, and I thought if I do some new stuff, that's where it might live too. So anyway, $6 or more on the Patreon, and you get cool stuff. Also, if you want a T-shirt, $6 or more, just if that's your donation, message me, and I will send you a T-shirt while supplies and sizes of those supplies last. Again, all you need to know, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. And also, I want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, which is my adopted hometown, and I miss it so much since we left. And I wonder, and I hope, well, I wonder how those places are doing, but I hope they're doing okay. I imagine they're not doing great, but during this pandemic, but I hope they are. Please, if you're in the area and they're open for business, go check them out. Also, Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. Similar deal. Love that place. Miss it. And all of those places offer in-kind support for this show, so I can't thank them enough. Thanks, too, to Jim Guthrie. My pal Jim lends me some music for the show. You can learn more about Jim and his wares at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Alyssa Cole. I hope you found it intriguing and are intrigued enough to check out her various books. She's probably written 3 books since I started this outro, and they're probably all out, and I don't even know about them yet. That's the way it goes with Alyssa. She's very busy, and I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll subscribe to the podcast and tell your friends to check it out, maybe do the same, spread the word about it, and that's it. That's all I can ask. It's probably more than I can ask. Thanks for listening to this. I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.